There were quite a few questions that some of you wrote in, so there's plenty to talk about today. I thought I'd start, was kind of on my mind to reflect about in any case, was how metta fits in to the practice. And one of the questions came up about saying something about the role of what this person wrote of as generative practices like loving kindness in this open awareness style. I think generative practices would include things like concentration as well, any kind of practice that is aimed at cultivating a particular quality in the mind. And I'd say that in general, in terms of those as practices, that's not the main direction of this style. We preference more the receptive, just meeting what's already here. If it happens to be metta that's arising, of course we notice that. And that is a support for the cultivation of metta. Wholesome qualities, when we attend to them with wise attention, with wise mindfulness, when we bring our mindful awareness and wisdom to be curious about the experience of wholesome states like metta, it creates the conditions for them to strengthen. So when wholesome qualities arise, it's really useful to pay attention to them, to be aware of them. And that's our instruction. Notice what's arising. If metta's arising, notice it. If joy's arising, notice that. If calm's arising, notice that. Equanimity, patience, all of those wholesome qualities, they arise. And often those are in the field of wise attitude. I think I have talked about notice. You know, when you notice the attitude, if it doesn't seem like there's greed or aversion or confusion in the mind, if it feels like the practice is going well, checking the attitude can help us to actually become more familiar with those wholesome qualities, because the wise attitude is connected to those wholesome qualities in the mind. When the mind is balanced and okay with what's happening, the quality of patience may be there, the quality of compassion may be there, the quality of interest may be there. And so that recognition of that will support those to be developed. And so in terms of the development of the wholesome qualities, that's the main support, is being aware of them. And yet those practices are also kind of tools in a way that many of us have cultivated and help us to kind of come into balance at times. And so I think early on in the retreat I said, you know, if the mind is feeling like it's getting whipped around by what's arising, and it's not possible, because it does happen that it feels like, or that the experience is, there's something arising, and just simply saying, oh yeah, that's what's arising, is not enough. It's like the mindfulness is not strong enough to meet that. And when that happens, it's really useful to have some means by which we can get regrounded, get reconnected, get back to some measure of balance. It's not useful to keep trying to preference, oh, I'm just supposed to be with what is, you know, that's all that I'm supposed to do, when the mind is just being whipped around by unwholesome qualities and we can't really be aware of them. And so this, I think I said this early on, you know, learning to distinguish when we can hold the reactive states with mindfulness and be curious about them versus when those reactive states are taking control of the mind. And when that's happening, using some of these generative strategies like metta practice can be really helpful. And so these practices that help the mind to construct or support the mind to find its way back to metta or to concentration, you know, using the breath, for example, if that feels helpful, or attuning to hearing and just letting go of the physical sensations for a time so that the mind can come back to balance. And then, given that this is the style that we're practicing in, you know, when there is some balance, then opening back up to, okay, and what's here right now? And following a period of time of using one of those kinds of practices, one of those more focused practices like metta practice, it can be quite lovely to shift to open awareness practice and recognize what's here, having done that metta practice, really kind of taking in the quality of the mind. Maybe the metta is there, or maybe there's some subtleness or ease, or the heart has relaxed a bit. And so it's not like we stop doing that and then go, okay, I'm supposed to pay attention to what is, so let me look for something. What's here is what is. So as we use those practices, as we kind of come back, open up again, starting from what's here, having been doing that practice. Just curiosity about that. A few minutes ago I said, when wholesome qualities are arising, it's valuable to know that they're arising. I think actually sometimes wholesome qualities can be a place where our minds kind of almost get complacent, or they just kind of drift off, because many times those wholesome qualities are pleasant. And, you know, the state of calm, for instance, we can just kind of float off into calm and not have mindfulness really be with it. And so the kind of attunement to, oh, this is what it's like to be calm, this is tranquility, that supports. It supports those states, it supports the mind to be with what's here, and it also supports that movement in the direction of those wholesome qualities. And so noticing that they're arising. Sometimes this can happen in surprising ways. At least for me, it seemed that way. They kind of slip in sometimes. They slip in under the guise of thinking. At one point I was doing a more kind of focused practice. I was at IMS at the 3-month course, and I was doing more of the breath practice. And I kept noticing that my mind kept being pulled off into thinking about these friends. And my agenda was being with the concentration. And so I was like, okay, that's a distraction. Come back. Be with the breath. But it kept happening. You know, it was very strong, this pull to these friends. And they were friends I hadn't thought about in ages. They were, you know, friends from the Peace Corps. These just kept appearing in my mind. And so at some point, it's like, okay, well, this is what's happening. So, you know, let's see what's here. And as I opened to that, it's like, okay, these thoughts are what's here. Metta was what was there. And it was kind of like my mind was saying, we're interested in exploring metta right now, not breath meditation right now. And it was kind of like trying to get me to pay attention by throwing up these flares, like, think about these friends, you know. And at the point when I kind of opened to the metta, it's like the friends were right there, but the thoughts fell away. It was more the experience of the metta connected to those beings. So this is, you know, I wasn't doing open awareness practice at that time, but, you know, this kind of thing can happen where, you know, we have this idea or judgment about thoughts as being somehow a distraction, and so we don't really attend to what's happening in the field with those thoughts. And that's exactly what we're doing with this practice. So when thoughts are arising, we check in. How are they affecting us? What's here with those thoughts? And so metta can slip in that way. Joy, delight, patience, all kinds of wholesome qualities can slip in through thinking. Thinking is not always a manifestation of reactivity. So, you know, to treat it that way, sometimes we can miss these doorways towards some of the wholesome qualities. And, you know, if you're exploring thoughts in that way, you're also going to sometimes see the reactivity, but then that's great, because then you're, instead of being lost in flagellating your mind with those thoughts and reactivity, you're aware, oh, right, I'm frustrated. This is frustration happening right now. And the mind can settle with that. That's what I love about this practice. It's like equal opportunity practice. It doesn't matter what's happening. We just notice. If thoughts are coming up and metta's with them, great. If thoughts are coming up and irritation is with them, great. We just notice it. The other way, I'll just remind you of this because I did mention this, but I thought of like kind of making a package here of all of the ways in which I see the relationship between metta and some other wholesome qualities and this practice. I think I mentioned earlier that you know, we're exploring this possibility of allowing our experience to be just as it is, and that we keep checking the attitude to see if there's some part of our mind that's not allowing it to be just as it is, and that checking the attitude and noticing kind of what's in the way of the allowing moves us in the direction of the allowing. And allowing might be thought of more as kind of the wisdom side, you know, things as they are. That framing, yata bhuta, the Buddha often encouraging us to notice experience as it is, yata bhuta, the Pali for that, as it actually is. And that's a wisdom phrase, noticing experience as it actually is, allowing it to be as it actually is. But the experience with that allowing, it's so close. It's like it's right up against connection and love and intimacy. And if we kind of reflect on what happens if we're in a field with somebody who's letting us be exactly as we are, now that feels pretty good. It's experienced as love when somebody can be with us and just let us be. not judging us, not having us, wanting us to do anything other than what we're already doing, when they're really fully with us and letting us be as we are, that experience feels like acceptance and love. And that is essentially in the quality of mind that has that perspective of allowing things to be just as they are. And so this practice of bringing that perspective of allowing, to me, it's like we could say that it's loving awareness that we're cultivating, or kind awareness that we're cultivating. We're cultivating wisdom and love simultaneously in this practice. We can have a kind of a preference or kind of almost a skew to think about particular words, like things as they are. You know, it's like knowing things as they are, or equanimity, you know, that when the mind is balanced and at ease with what's happening, non-reactivity, you know, that may sound like not emotionally connected. But the mind that is not reactive, that's not reactive to what's happening, the possibility for connection is right there. We can kind of lean into, or the mind can kind of lean into the equanimity side, the wisdom side, the, yep, thing, this is how things are, and the mind is not kind of being flailed around by it. And we can also kind of be curious about, with that space of balanced mind, what other qualities are there, perhaps? Or for one time, one teacher encouraged me, because I kept describing in my experience, you know, one thing that happened to me quite a bit in my early years of being a teacher was that I would be sitting with people in meetings and really right there and right present being with them. And their kind of response to me was something like, I so feel your compassion. And this was interesting to me because that wasn't my experience. I was experiencing really just the sense of being available to meet what was arising. And I was very curious about this and asked a number of my colleagues and people, teachers that I respected, about this, and several of them just said, oh, don't worry about it, it's there. I was like, well, that doesn't help me, I'm not feeling it. And so I kept just, like, you know, exploring this, and at one point I talked to Philip Moffitt about this, and he had the most clear and just beautiful instruction for me. He said, your mind is orienting towards emptiness. It's orienting towards conditionality. It's orienting towards, you know, impermanence. And, you know, it's orienting towards that side of the experience. He said, when you're sitting with somebody, orient towards the relational and see what happens. And so I did that, you know, the next time I sat with her, and I had an opportunity, like, minutes later to see what happened. And I was sitting with them and just feeling, you know, like this, I'm really present right here. And then it's like I brought in, essentially, now reflecting back on it and thinking about what we're talking about this week, the external, I brought in the external awareness. This is a human being sitting in front of me. That it was that simple, you know. Just that simple to reflect on. This is another human being sitting here. And the love and the compassion were right there. It did take a slight shift of mind, or an opening, or a kind of a... So the perception was oriented the habit of the perception was oriented more towards wisdom. And it took a little bit of a kind of a, let's see, can we shift to a different type of perception here? Let's be in a relational way, just talking as human beings, you know, just being together as people. And it was that simple to touch into the qualities of love and compassion that were there. And it did feel like they were there. It just felt like they were not being attended to. And so, you know, this kind of thing can happen when we explore, open to, when the mind is balanced and at ease, allowing what's here. Sometimes it can be as simple as attuning to the relational. You know, you're attending to what's here, and it may be that you're kind of in that stepped back place in the separated, you know, watching things. Attune to the relational and see what happens. So I feel very much like this practice does support the cultivation of love, of compassion, of joy. Attending to experience in the way that we're attending to it brings those qualities along. And sometimes it can help to kind of lean or turn in that direction to say, what's the relationship here? There's another way that it feels like metta is, it's possible for metta to be revealed in this practice. I've talked about this in I think just one of the groups. And I've talked about it a lot in the past, so many of you have heard this before. Having sat, you know, retreats with me before. But again, I'll just remind you or bring it in. Whatever is arising, you know, when there's some kind of a reactive experience arising, some kind of dukkha arising, it feels to me like there's this kind of underlying structure that dukkha is related to, that can be described in this way. That there's a kind of, much of the time when we're experiencing some kind of reactivity, there's a thread in our minds back to some kind of wish to be safe, to be happy, to be healthy, to live a life of ease. And those are the wishes of metta. And so, you know, the strategies, I mean, it's a very deep movement in our hearts to move towards metta, to move towards well-being. You know, this is it's a human movement to have these wishes for ourselves and for others. And, you know, what happens often in our lives and our experiences, like we learn, we're trying to find ways to feel safe and happy and healthy and feel at ease. And the strategies that we come up with as children, you know, all the training that we've had, all of the, you know, conditioning that we've grown up with, we've learned particular strategies to try to find ways to be safe, happy, healthy. And, you know, those wishes, that metta wish, that underlying metta wish, which I think is a strong motivator for much of our behavior. You know, if we look at fear, if we look at confusion, if we look at greed, you know, it's often based in wanting to have security and wanting to have safety and wanting to not be in danger, you know, that there's all of that happening. And so underlying that is that wish, that movement towards happiness, health, safety, ease. But it's getting a little tied up. It's kind of getting tied up in knots, and often where it gets tied up in knots is that there's this other kind of reality that we run into in living our lives. You know, the reality that we don't like to see, that we spend our lives trying to strategize how to avoid, that things are impermanent, unreliable, and uncontrollable. And so, you know, it's like, this is what's happening. We've got this movement, this wish, this direction towards, may I be happy, healthy, and safe? And it, like, runs right up against the truth, the kind of nature of experience as impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. And because we don't have a way to navigate or haven't learned a way to navigate that these two things can actually coexist simultaneously. It's like we have this kind of wish to be safe running up against unreliable experience, unreliable. And it's like safety's not possible. And so we get tied up in knots. You know, and you know what I think happens sometimes with the reactivity is either we are kind of railing against the unreliability here. You know, it's like it shouldn't be unreliable. If it's unreliable, I'm at fault, or somebody else is to blame for making it unreliable. So we're blaming somebody about, instead of recognizing, no, this is just the nature of things. Things are unreliable. Experience is unreliable. So either we go that route to blame or shame or, you know, judge ourselves around what is just the nature of experience, or we kind of go the direction of feeling like, well, if this is the nature of the way things are, then I must not be worthy of being safe and happy and healthy. I must not be, you know, that must not be a valid wish. And so we kind of try to squash that wish, or squash that wish. And so, you know, the reactivity seems to be born either by, like, it's like the mind thinks these two things can't coexist simultaneously. And so it either is trying to deny the reality of the impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable nature of experience, or it's trying to deny the validity of that wish for well-being. And so this is it's a shift of the mind to begin to, like, hold the possibility that these two can coexist. You know, what seems to happen, that I like to think of the reactivity that gets born with the kind of juxtaposition of these two. Like, I think of these as threads, right? You know, it's like the threads of well-wishing, meta-wishes, and these threads of impermanent, unreliable. So we've got this. And what happens with the lack of understanding that these things can coexist is that we get a knot. We get a tangle. And our kind of usual approach, and here I'm going to go into the analogy a little bit, of like we've got a weave of things, we've got fibers coming together, and we've got this knot, this kind of lump in our cloth of a knot. And, you know, how do I get rid of that? Well, maybe I need to, like, you know, cut it out and put a patch over it or something. Well, you know, when you take the scissors and you cut it out, you're cutting out the threads, so you end up with a hole in the cloth. And if that's our approach with mindfulness, to think, and I did think this, like with myself, with my experience of self-hatred, I thought the entirety of it was like, it was all bad. You know, it needed to be excised. It was like a tumor, and I needed to figure out how to get the scalpel out and cut it out and throw it away because it was a problem. But this kind of model or this kind of way of describing it, it's like that, even that self-hatred was this tangle between wanting to be happy and loved and love and this sense of not having control. And so, you know, the struggle, the suffering that experience of that self-hatred, it's like it's a knot, but it's kind of composed of both the wishes towards happiness and the truths of uncontrollability, unreliability, impermanence. And so the movement to excise it and get rid of it, that's not going to work very well. There'll be resistance to that because the truths are the truths. They're not going anywhere. And those wishes are valid, deep, human, wholesome wishes. And so the path to this is like untangling the tangle. That's what has to happen. And we might think we need to get in there and pull the knot apart, but really it's more like, you know, the mindfulness and the wisdom are a lubricant. You put the knot in that lubricant, and it's like it begins to unknot itself. And then we have this weave, a cloth without the knot, and we begin to get the sense of, yes, the wish for safety is and well-being, it's a valid wish. And the truths are the truths. These two do not have to be in conflict. It's counterintuitive that these two are not in conflict. And that kind of opening, you know, it's like whenever there's dukkha arising, it seems as though with that dukkha, because that dukkha is composed of these threads, it's like they're available. They're part of what can be seen in the mix. So with self-hatred arising, with fear arising, that was an experience I had at one point, that seeing a strong fear arising and then kind of recognizing that the wish for safety was right there. And every now and then I could touch into that and the fear would actually dissolve for a little while, and then the mind would like remember uncontrollable and the fear would come right back. But the watching or being with our dukkha states, our reactive states, there's threads both to pointing us back that we can open to in the being with, in that place of the lubricant, that it points us back to the wishes for happiness and well-being. It points us back to that love, that wish that we be safe and happy and healthy. It points us also back to the truths. So right there, within the midst of dukkha, is everything we need to learn about love and wisdom. And so as we open to our dukkha, we learn something about the unreliable, uncontrollable nature of experience, but we can also touch into that metta for ourselves, for others, opening our heart. So it's again, it's this love and wisdom thing. They just seem like they're right together, you know, with the talking about the allowing and the love, you know, those two things being so close. This too, right in the midst of reactivity, wisdom and love are in the mix. Can we have the patience and the confidence and the courage? It takes courage to be with that reactivity, letting these threads reveal themselves and untangle themselves in their time. There are some other questions about wholesome states. I'll just, in particular around joy, so since this is, seems to be the, you know, part of the thread of what is coming up, you know, looking at wholesome states. I'll look at two kind of reflections or questions. One is pointing to the one asutta that there's several versions of this list, and I mentioned it yesterday in the talk. I mentioned the teaching of transcendent dependent origination, which is a set of conditions that are supportive towards freedom. I didn't name them yesterday so much, but I'll name them now. So in the transcendent dependent origination list, this list begins with suffering and faith that there's a way to meet that suffering. In other versions of this list, it's the same series, except for these first two, and it sometimes begins with skillful behavior, with virtue, with sila. And it says, with virtuous behavior, with sila, what follows from that, or what's kind of the natural progression from that, is non-remorse. That when we engage skillfully, there's nothing to have remorse about. And there's one flavor of this that I particularly like, one flavor of this list that I particularly like, that says, when there is virtuous behavior, it doesn't take an act of will for non-remorse to arise. It is the natural consequence. And so it's not like we have to do non-remorse. It arises with the conditions of engaging skillfully. And then the next link is with non-remorse as condition. It doesn't take an act of will for delight to arise. It's the natural unfolding. And so this sequence that I'm going to just read the links of right now, this is its own, like, multiple Dharma talks. Gil and I have done entire two-week retreats on this teaching. but I think it's instructive in just one little highlight that I want to offer here. So in the transcendent dependent origination, it begins with suffering, and then the faith that there's something possible, you know, that there's a possibility for freedom from faith, I mean, freedom from suffering. You know, that we've heard a teaching, and that, in this version, it's like that leads to delight. So the faith is a supportive condition for delight to arise, because there's like the kind of the sense of, oh, somebody knows a way. Oh, okay, maybe this is, you know, I can step onto this path. And so delight can arise with that. Following from delight, joy. From joy, tranquility. From tranquility, happiness. With happiness as a supportive condition, concentration arises. That was not my sense of what was supportive for concentration when I first started this practice. I thought it was hard work. But relaxation, ease, happiness, that's a supportive condition for concentration. With concentration, there is the possibility of seeing, knowing and seeing things as they are. So that allowing, that yata bhuta, that phrase is one of the links in this chain. Yata bhuta nanadasana, the knowing of seeing and the knowing and seeing of things as they are. With that knowing and seeing of things as they are, we become disenchanted with our usual strategies for happiness, because we recognize that our usual strategies for happiness are dependent on this misunderstanding that things are reliable, that things are lasting, that there's a possibility of control. So we get disenchanted. This disenchantment piece often doesn't feel so good. You know, it's like the bubble has been burst, and it sometimes feels pretty uncomfortable to be in that place. But as the mind, and that's kind of that place where we begin to recognize, yeah, these things can exist simultaneously. You know, the truths, impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, can begin to exist. You know, we understand it's not a conflict, that they can exist simultaneously with the wish for well-being. And that disenchantment then begins to, it's like with the disenchantment, the, you know, our usual strategies for finding well-being get burst. You know, it's like, yeah, the ways that we've gone about it in the past, those don't seem to work. And so we begin to kind of navigate finding the way towards those qualities being a support in a different way. Those qualities of love and joy and compassion supporting us, not to get something that we want, but to connect us, to open our hearts. So from that disenchantment, as the mind becomes disenchanted with its usual strategies, it begins to have what's called dispassion. That word sometimes is interpreted, you know, kind of on the wisdom side, it's interpreted as not having feeling. But I think perhaps it's more, you know, the dispassion of not being passionate around greed, aversion, and delusion. Greed, aversion, and delusion can have a kind of a passionate quality to them. But the release from greed, aversion, and delusion, and this, the next link following dispassion is release. That release from greed, aversion, and delusion. We find that it's not about being like some automaton that doesn't feel. I love that the word compassion has passion in it. You know, dispassion doesn't negate compassion. It negates the passion around the reactive states. The mind understands they're not skillful strategies. And so there's a release. The mind releases that. And that is freedom. And so the kind of piece I want to just name here is that the first, like, half of this chain, delight, joy, tranquility, happiness, that's the foundation for the understanding. And I feel like these interweave. It's like, it's not that the delight and joy arise and then they end. They kind of like are, continue supporting us. And so, you know, one of the other questions was like, a question or kind of comments about the joy of clear seeing, regardless of what's seen. You know, that this, that yatabhuta, that seeing things as they are, when the mind is in that place to just know things as they are, there can be just a delight and a joy in that. You know, it can come early in ways of like being out in nature and just being kind of in awe of the trees and the shadows that change as the wind blows. And, you know, it's just really delightful, that experience of being present. And somebody brought that up today and asked, is that okay? Is that just greed? And no, this kind of pleasure comes with being present. You know, sometimes when we're that present, you know, raindrops on a puddle of water are awesome. You know, it's like, yeah, it's not something that we would normally think of as beauty. Oh, like a splotch of dirt on the ground is like, oh my gosh, look at that. Wow. Look at how it's just like weaving out into like nothing on the ends. It just disappears. That kind of delight, and as I said this morning in the group when this came up, it's like a great thing to check into is how does the heart, you know, if that joy and delight is connected with wanting more or holding on, there's going to be some constriction. It's not going to be like a sense of openness and ease. Now, craving manifests as a kind of attention and tightness. And so I use this all the time in my practice. It's like checking into the heart. Just this area seems to be a really lovely place that kind of resonates with the purity of mind, the feeling of that heart when the mind is not reactive. It feels open and expansive and soft and spacious. And when there's craving, it feels tight and constricted and contracted. It's like it's a simple, like, you don't have to even know what the constriction is. It's like, oh yeah, there's constriction here. Or there's space here, there's spaciousness here. So that can be a way to, I mean, because we can cling to anything. You know, the mind has no shame about that. It will, you know, it can cling to the delight and joy of meditation, and we're warned about that sometimes. But, you know, this to me is a really great way to check in. It's like, yes, it is true that it can arise that, you know, that kind of leaning into when a beautiful state of mind is happening. Like, oh, I want this to continue. Oh, yeah, ooh. What we're asked to do is just to notice that. Not to either try to somehow get rid of that wanting, which is a very natural unfolding based on our conditioning. When things pleasant happen, when our mind is moving in the direction of well-being, of course it wants to move in the direction of well-being. Of course that habit of wanting comes in there. And the we are asked to recognize if there's constriction along with that, that the wanting to move in that direction can be wholesome. And if it's wholesome, it'll have more of that open quality. But if it's got the, ooh, gotta hold on to this, it'll have more of that constricted quality. And we're not asked to get rid of it or to judge ourselves for this, because the path is through being in that lubricant. Oh, there's the, you know, the constriction around wanting this to continue. Of course there's a wanting this to continue. The mind is, you know, wishing itself well, and it's misunderstanding something about how that deeper kind of happiness is possible. It goes back to its strategy of, this is happiness, I better hold on to it. Which just, you know, diminishes it. Diminishes the quality of it. And that's what I think we start to recognize, is like that habit of, you know, the holding on. It's hard to trust that if I don't hold on, actually the qualities grow and strengthen. Like I said at the beginning, you know, that just that wise mindfulness strengthens those qualities. It's hard to trust that, because our conditioning has told us, in order to get something, I've got to, like, hold on to it. And so it's a learning over time. And we get tastes of that. We get tastes of that, that recognition of, oh yeah, if I just, like, settle back, there's a different kind of well-being that I didn't even know was possible. And the mind forgets that. It goes back to its strategies. Remembers again. So there were a lot more questions. But I'll hold on to them and bring them in other ways and times. So thank you for offering the questions. Sometimes it's delightful to just see what comes up instead of thinking about it in advance. So let's sit together for a couple of minutes.